From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. The coronavirus pandemic has wiped out over 40 million jobs and a countless number of livelihoods. Workers of color have borne the brunt of the economic crisis, putting their lives at risk doing essential work on the front lines of the pandemic or losing employment altogether. African American workers are enduring an especially difficult moment. This hour on Point, African American employment during and after the pandemic. With us from Washington First, Valerie Wilson. She is director of the Economic Policy Institute's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. She co-authored an important new study from the EPI titled Black Workers Face Two of the Most Lethal Pre-Existing Conditions for Coronavirus, Racism and Economic Inequality. Valerie Wilson, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you. So this study looked into the myriad ways that racial and economic inequality have exacerbated the impact of the coronavirus on Black communities, on communities of color. We'll dig into the details, but what's the headline of this important report?
Yeah, I think you summarized it very well at the beginning. We identified three main groups of workers in the COVID-19 economy. The first group being the tens of millions who have lost their jobs and as a result of that are facing economic insecurity. The second group are those who have been identified as essential workers and so have some degree of job security, but also face greater health insecurity. The third group are those who are able to continue working from the safety of their homes and so have a job, they continue to receive a paycheck, and also have greater health security. Black workers are least likely to be in that last group and so have few good options for protecting both their health and their economic well-being. Mm.
So let's start with the labor market. Let's start there. Unemployment rates have been off the charts, of course, for all workers. But they've been even higher for African Americans. Give us the numbers and explain why.
So today we had a new report on the numbers from May, and that showed that overall the unemployment rate, as most did not expect, actually fell to 13.3%. But that severely masks the disparities across different racial and ethnic groups. The Black unemployment rate was 16.8%, is actually a tenth of a percentage point higher than it was in April. The white unemployment rate is 12.4%.
And that's down. Yeah.
That is down. That's an improvement. The Hispanic employment rate improved a bit to 17.6%. It's still the highest unemployment rate among the racial and ethnic groups that are reported. And the Asian unemployment rate is currently 15%. It also ticked up slightly in May.
And Black women have faced the highest rates of unemployment in all categories. Why are Black women bearing the major brunt of this downturn?
Yeah, and that's one of the features that we wanted to draw out in our report. We reported the April increases in unemployment rates by gender and race, and showing that Black women had a significantly higher rise in their unemployment rate relative to white women, not only measured by the unemployment rate, but also in looking at the employment population ratio, which measures the percentage of people who are employed. So it, you know, does away with that condition of having to have actively sought employment in the last month. I think one of the reasons why we're seeing higher rates of unemployment among Black women and Latino women as well has to do with the industries that were hardest hit when the pandemic hit this country, being in hospitality and restaurant and healthcare to some extent as well. I think another significant factor in that comes through today's report showing that state and local employment declined by 1.6 million, and about half of that was in public K-12 education, a sector of the economy that employs a significant number of Black women. But I think the other issue, facing women has to do with the demands for responsibility for care. And so with schools being closed, with there being fewer child care options available, I think women may be more reluctant or more delayed in going back to work when there are jobs available. Mm.
There was another important statistic from your report that African Americans have disproportionately higher death rates from coronavirus. Blacks make up 12% of the population, but they account for 22.4% of COVID deaths in the United States. That's almost double the death rate for whites. How do you account for that?
Yeah, you know, that is a feature of, you know, a number of factors. You know, we've heard a lot about the underlying health conditions that put people at greater risk to die from coronavirus, that being asthma, hypertension, diabetes, and obesity. African-Americans are more likely than whites to have each of those health conditions. But it's also true that the geography of outbreaks hasn't been uniform across the country. So another statistic that the Centers for Disease Control has been providing, which is where we got the numbers that you just cited and were included in our report, they also look at a weighted share of the population that accounts for the demographics in areas that have been experiencing more outbreaks. And the share of the Black population in those areas is higher at 18.2% than the overall share in the broader population. So there's a concentration of African-American workers in those areas that have had higher outbreaks. There's greater prevalence of the kinds of health conditions that put people at greater risk. And there are other things, I think, that play into that we get into as well, in specifically thinking about housing structures and people's ability to effectively socially distance if they do contract the virus.
There's another statistic that was interesting that we have heard. Black workers are disproportionately represented in grocery, convenience store jobs, public transit, warehouse, social services positions. 17% of all frontline workers are African-American, Valerie Wilson, and that frontline work has put them at greater risk during this pandemic as well.
Yeah, and I think it's important to understand that not only does that frontline work put them at greater risk, when we look at access to different kinds of benefits that are important for workers if they're going to be at increased health risk, we know that African-American workers are less likely to have health insurance and less likely to have paid sick leave. Mm-hmm. So not only are they faced with greater exposure to coronavirus, but many of the kinds of benefits and supports that would be important to a worker to be able to address those health issues are lacking for so many of them.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now from Columbus, Ohio, Derek Hamilton. He is executive director of the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. He was a senior economic advisor to Bernie Sanders and is now a member of the Sanders-Joe Biden Joint Task Force. Derek Hamilton, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane. Glad to be here and always glad to share stage with Valerie Wilson.
Thanks
Absolutely.
To you both. Well, Derek, what do you hear? What do you see in Valerie's research?
I think some of the clear value of this research is to point out that the coronavirus, a pandemic that's supposed to be somewhat random, is not having random effects, that they are evident effects that impact us differently based on race.
And you've also said, despite all that, that what we're seeing in this country, the uprising, the violence, the protests, the riots, the anxiety that's happening right now, you've said we are naive if we think that that is separable from the economic calamity that so many of us are in, especially African Americans. How do you see this moment with relation to all of that?
And that narrative includes both gloom and some optimism. The gloom is the fact that a police officer in broad daylight could literally kill somebody with his knee in his neck is the result of a devaluation of someone based on their identity. The fact that we have a political economy that allows for the property rights of whiteness. And, you know, this is not a bug of the feature of the system, but a feature. In other words, how we got here, and this is a somewhat nuanced argument, I'll try to make it quick. We've had over 45 years of growing inequality with concentration of both political and economic power at the top. In order for this system to persist and not have political upheaval, what has been offered tactically is relative status to the dominant population. And it was plainly made by President Trump when he ran in 2016, when he talked about building walls. And that is really the codification of a relative status of whiteness. And I'd say that's the gloom. The gloom is we have a political economy that permits a devaluation of Black lives so that we can see incidents like that. And then this is all connected because the positive, the optimism, is that there is upheaval in the streets. There is protest in the street. And this protest is not limited to the Black community, particularly with young people, young white people. They are taken to the streets and demanding justice. So they are willing to sacrifice the privileges that go along with being white in exchange for a more just system where we have greater prosperity for everyone, not this system of concentration at the top.
Valerie, you also see connective tissue between the pandemic and the protests over these last 10 days since George Floyd's killing. As it all relates to your research, what's the nexus to your mind?
Yeah, well, as Derek has already so eloquently stated, all of these things are connected to systems and structures that have been in place since this nation's founding. We may be looking at different outcomes, whether it be police brutality, whether it be outright murder of Black people by other civilians, or whether it be the strains caused by coronavirus on the health and economic well-being of African Americans. The root of all of that is racism and devaluation, as Derek stated, of Black people.
Well, we will broaden out your research, Valerie Wilson, after the break. Talk about the wealth gap, the Black middle class, many things. Valerie Wilson, director of the Economic Policy Institute's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. She's co-authored this new EPI study. And Derek Hamilton, a scholar, executive director at the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State. Stick with me, both of you, listeners. We're discussing African-American employment, which has been among the hardest hit during the pandemic and has been dealt a significant blow to Black households across the country. More to come after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing the economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic and looking specifically at the impact on African-American workers. With me this hour, Valerie Wilson, director of the Economic Policy Institute's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy, and Derek Hamilton, executive director of the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. Well, prior to the pandemic, the unemployment rate for Black Americans had gone as low as 5.5%. Here is President Trump in 2018 at the State of the Union address touting that turnaround.
And something I'm very proud of, African American unemployment stands at the lowest rate ever recorded.
And here's Democratic Senator Kamala Harris responding to the president's claim that he deserved credit for the improved job situation for Black workers.
Many people, including members of the Congressional Black Caucus, were not applauding. And probably because we all know that the way that he should have made that statement is at the end of that statement, he should have said, "Thank you, President Obama."
So, Valerie Wilson, Derek Hamilton, the unemployment rate for African-American workers was at an all-time low just before the pandemic. President Trump has talked a lot about that. The Federal Reserve said it was a sign of a strong economy, that gains were being broadly shared. What did you make of those numbers now compared to these that are so much higher than all the rest? Valerie Wilson?
Yeah, you know, there was something that I think was missing from a lot of the boasting about the Black unemployment rate being at a record low. That was true. But even at that low point, it was still double the white unemployment rate. And the fact is, I think that any individual president can take little credit for what happens in terms of a specific demographic's employment prospects unless they have very specific, targeted, intentional policies in place to really address those issues. I would argue that one of the reasons why the Black unemployment rate got to such a low level during the recovery was because we had been in recovery for an extended period of time. We know that the data historically shows that the longer an economy is in a recovery, the Black unemployment rate is more likely to improve. And so I think that's part of that. What we saw when the pandemic hit was that there was an immediate and widespread a job loss that hit all groups. And interestingly, the numbers in April showed about a 10 to 12 percentage point increase across the board. And, you know, because that 12, 11 points was added on top of a higher number for Black workers, the Black rate was still higher than the white unemployment rate. And as we just have seen in May, the Black unemployment rate did not improve even as the overall rate declined. Mm.
Derek Hamilton, speak to that. What is your perspective?
You know, all of what Valerie said, there's a structure in the numbers that is related to race, where Black people generally have a higher unemployment rate relative to whites, even when one controls for education. In fact, in many economic domains, disparities rise with education, which is paradoxical. But here's a big point. The nature of work has changed and is changing. So what a good job means today is not the same thing as what a good job meant yesteryear. Jobs now are more volatile in terms of workers knowing how much they're going to make from week to week and even how long they will work from week to week. We have an emergence of a gig economy, which, you know, again, if we're looking at job numbers in a historical context, one needs to take account that the nature of work is changing. And I will give a lot of credit to Bradley Hardy, a scholar who's been documenting the volatility within our employment sector, particularly by race.
Well, you mentioned education, and interestingly, unemployment rates for African-American workers are higher at every level of education. Valerie Wilson, you talk about this in your study from the Economic Policy Institute. If you are African-American, if you haven't finished high school, or if you have an advanced degree, historically, Blacks have higher unemployment rates across the board, and those numbers are striking. Help us understand what they reveal.
Yeah, I think that really strikes back against this idea of meritocracy in America and the fact that if you work hard, if you go get an education and do the things that we're all told to do, that, you know, things will work out fine for you. Now, on one hand, it is true that on average, if you are a Black college graduate, you're more likely to be employed than an African-American person who does not have a college degree. But it does not make you immune to racial discrimination. And thus we see that disparity at every level of education, that race continues to be a factor, even when controlling for that. That's true in unemployment, and it's also true in wages.
Mm. So let's talk about the wealth gap here, because that was an important part of your study, Valerie Wilson. Overall, white families on average hold more than five times as many assets as Black families in this country. The median household income for white households is about 70% higher than for Black households. Help us understand that better, Valerie.
Yeah, and I'll say a little bit, but I really should defer to Derek on this. He and Sandy Derry and a number of others have done a tremendous amount of work in this area in elevating the issue of the racial wage gap. But in our paper specifically, we focused on cash reserves, our liquid assets, because in this situation, we're facing a pandemic. It's important that people can quickly access additional funds if they lose their job or are unable to go to work. And that was the 5-to-1 statistic that you cited. The average African-American family has about $9,000 in cash reserves compared to about $50,000 for white families.
Derek, you've said we, quote, exaggerate the economic returns on education, particularly for marginalized groups, particularly for African-Americans. How so?
We exaggerate it because, as we just discussed in terms of the racial wealth gap, we exaggerate the functional role of education to the expense of understanding the functional role of wealth. And I guess the point being is that even when Black households get high levels of education, they're still in a precarious situation. And that is clearly marked by the fact that Black households where the head graduated from college typically have less wealth than white households where the head dropped out of high school. And what is meaningful about this, again, is wealth is valuable in terms of what it can be, what it can do for you. We think about wealth as an outcome, but if you have wealth, you would have been better protected during this pandemic. If you had a pre-existing health condition and you were told by your employer that you had to show up for work and risk your own life, well, if you have no wealth, you can't refuse that employer. But if you had liquid assets, you can say, you know what, I'm not coming to work. I'm not putting my life at risk. And that's just one example of the ways in which we really need to understand that it is capital foundation, particularly in the terms of wealth, that empowers people. And Black people are pretty much penniless if we think about it in the dimension of assets.
Less liquidity, Valerie Wilson, less savings. Black families have significantly less cash reserves to draw from than white families. And so when it comes to unemployment, as you're saying, as Derek is saying, when Black households lose income, when they lose a job, the situation is much more precarious, Valerie.
Yeah, and you know, we've had a lot of discussion around this idea of essential workers. Another one of the statistics that we highlight in our paper is the fact that Black households are more likely to be single earner households. I think that's largely a reflection of this persistent 2-to-1 unemployment rate disparity that we see in the economy. But what that means in those single earner households, all of those workers are essential, because if they lose their job, the entire household is without income. And given the disparities in liquid assets, there's very little available, or if anything, for them to fall back on.
Black families, in your report, Valerie, are also less likely to own their own homes. And the homes that they do own are often worth less. And this point as well is important to note. While the Great Recession of 2007, 2008, and 2009 was painful for homeowners who had mortgages go underwater, what we're experiencing now is disproportionately hitting renters. And that's a group that's already been struggling with affordability, especially in the African-American community. Derek Hamilton, your thoughts?
And I wanted to make one other point about the disparate impact with regards to health and exposure to essential workers. And that is, looking at Valerie's point paper, all the different categories that might explain the differences in mortality rates, such as single earners, geography, pre-existing health conditions, those disparities between Blacks and whites, they are there, but they pale in comparison to both the disparities in terms of mortality and the disparities in terms of liquid assets. So to me, if you're looking for a causal explanation, one, it is liquid assets that might explain those other intermediary categories, and two, it is the fact that Blacks are financially not well positioned that is ultimately leading to this vulnerability. And as it relates to the question you raised, you know, we think about shelter and we think about home ownership in the sense that in the American context, home ownership has generally been the mechanisms by which middle income households or the typical American household has been able to accrue wealth. And that's an American context and an American feature. But what we also need to think about in the dimension of housing is shelter itself, is the vulnerability of simply having a place to live that is secure without the insecurity of having to be displaced. And there's great work that's emerging. You know, there's the Princeton sociologist. Sadly, I'm forgetting his name right now, but he's done his book called Eviction has really exposed the functional role of housing, how housing relates to people's situation and outcomes, and how Black people, particularly Black women, are exposed to the volatility of being displaced. And, you know, I don't want to get into the issue of Black women versus Black men, because on the flip side, we have a mass incarceration of Black men where I'm being somewhat snarky with this comment. Technically, there's housing, but obviously it's not housing that we desire for a population.
Valerie Wilson, speak to that, the functional role of housing and all this and how that impacts the African American community as you studied it.
Yeah, so, you know, we've talked a bit about the role of home ownership as a store of a means of wealth. But I think it is important that we focus specifically on the vulnerability faced by those who are renters. And the researcher that Derek referenced is Matthew Desmond, and the tremendous work that he's done in looking at the process of eviction. And really, it's a cycle of eviction that happens once someone faces that insecurity. And again, given that the majority of Black households are renters and not owners, not to diminish the risk that owners face as well, because we saw during the Great Recession that a disproportionate number of the foreclosures happened among African-American homeowners, and that too being tied to another kind of systemic discrimination whereby Black homeowners were given higher cost loans and more predatory loans that put them at greater risk.
Right.
So whether you're an owner or a renter, you're facing these issues with regards to affordability on top of facing a greater probability of losing your source of income by becoming unemployed.
I've got several callers here. Let me get one in first from Columbia, South Carolina. Hetlina is on the line. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm just listening, and I just had to call in because I'm here in South Carolina, and I have a circle, a variety of friends in different fields, and it's sad that I'm hearing the stories and know that a lot of it is that their counterparts are being able to hold a job. For example, I have some friends that are definitely self-employed, and they're finding that they're hearing that those who are white are getting paid before they get paid because they have connections in the office. I have friends that are in the nursing industry, and now they're getting furloughed, but basically their job may be, I guess every job is important for them, but their job may be more important than the counterpart's job, but yet they will be the one that get furloughed. Mm. And it's so sad that I'm hearing that. I don't want to believe that, but then I'm hearing it from those who are actually experiencing it firsthand. And so now they have less income coming in. They're fighting for unemployment still. I have friends that are still waiting for their unemployment to get approved.
Still waiting for that. Yeah, still waiting for that check. And many are. We have heard the same story. Hetlina, thank you very much for your call. Well, there's Hetlina on the front lines. I mean, experiencing exactly what we're talking about, Derek Hamilton. You have written and spoken a lot about a phenomenon you call first fired, last hired. Hetlina's call reminded me of that. Explain what you mean.
And this recession is a little different. It's a little different. Well, first off, irrespective of variety of demographic and socioeconomic conditions, it is a stylized fact that Black in the American economy compared to whites are generally the first fired and the last hired. And this gets exacerbated during an economic downturn. But this recession is different. This recession is different, and the numbers have bared out differently. So if we look at the April unemployment numbers, for example, there was more parity in terms of having mass despair amongst both Blacks and whites in terms of exposure to unemployment. And that's because we made a moral decision to basically shut down our economy in order to save lives as a result of a pandemic. And that's different from previous recessions, which were typically borne about by some speculative factor in the economy that needed to be adjusted because the economic fundamentals were at a mismatch. And then it led to a bursting of a bubble that led to a spillover downward spiral and it led to losses of jobs. But given this pandemic where we made a decision to literally stop the economy, jobs loss were pervasive across race. But now what are we starting to see with these June numbers at the beginning of June? The white unemployment is tilting down where the Black unemployment rate is still staying up. So that part about first being fired, well, that was different in this recession because we, again, decided to stop the economy on.
Derek, I think we lost you for a moment. Valerie Wilson, pick up what Derek was saying. And to this point, I think it was Governor Cuomo who said in a very well-meaning tweet that the pandemic is the great equalizer. But that's turned out not to be the case, especially if you look at these new numbers, Valerie.
Yeah, and we've said all along that, you know, on one hand, it's true that the pandemic has affected everyone in some way. And that's true not just in the United States, but globally. But the nature and magnitude of that effect is anything but universal. And so today's unemployment numbers bear that out. I think another point that's worth mentioning as it relates to this idea of last hired and first fired has to do with the historic low unemployment rate. We got there because we had been in recovery so long. If it had ended 5 years sooner, that rate would not have been historic. And that's because after 10 years, Black people were finally seeing significant gains in employment. Mm.
Well, we are discussing African-American unemployment in the wake of the pandemic and much more to come. We'll add William Darity to the conversation after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing the economic aftermath of the pandemic and its impact, especially on African-American workers. With us is Valerie Wilson, director of the Economic Policy Institute's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. Derek Hamilton, executive director of the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. And let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from Durham, North Carolina, is William Darity, professor of public policy, African-American studies, and economic at Duke University. He's also that school's director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equality. Great to have you with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. And I'm especially pleased to be on the air with two scholars I greatly admire, Valerie Wilson and Derek Hamilton.
Indeed. Three wonderful scholars here today. What are you hearing, Mr. Darity, in this conversation?
I'm hearing about the importance of the racial wealth gap as something that's fundamental to explaining the kinds of inequalities that have been exposed so grievously by both the pandemic and by the anti-Black police violence that has surfaced again so recently. I'm particularly interested in talking about the racial wealth gap because I think it's the most important indicator of economic security and economic well-being that we actually have. In the context of Black-white differences in wealth in the United States, Black Americans constitute about 13% of the nation's population, but only possess about 2.6% of the nation's wealth. And that staggering gap in the disproportion between population share and wealth share translates into a situation where the average Black household has a net worth that is $800,000 less than the net worth of the average white household.
Mm. Mm. Well, and to that point, I've heard Derek Hamilton and others say, you know, there's virtually never been a Black middle class in this country. To your point, how do you see that and how do we fix it?
So I've recently done a paper with Finaba Adu and Imari Smith, in which we argued that if you use wealth as the standard for trying to identify middle class status, there is, as Derek suggests, virtually no black middle class in the United States. In work that I've just completed with Kirsten Mullen, a book that just was published called From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, we've argued that the way in which you have to address the racial wealth gap is a direct way. And that's the route of adopting a reparations program that is designed specifically to eliminate black-white differences in wealth.
Well, and you've written an op-ed just recently making that case for reparations for African Americans as an even more compelling issue after the inequalities that Valerie Wilson has laid out because of the pandemic.
Yes, absolutely. And we've emphasized that it's important to understand that the racial wealth gap is a consequence of American policies. It is not a consequence of any form of dysfunctional behavior on the part of blacks or poor decision making on the part of blacks. As Derek pointed out, black heads of household with a college degree have 2/3 of the net worth of white heads of households who never finished high school. And so we have to look specifically at the trajectory of American social policy with respect to race to understand why the wealth gap exists. I would place the origin point or the starting point with the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, in which the formerly enslaved were promised 40-acre land grants, That promise was never fulfilled. Simultaneously, many, many white Americans received what we could refer to as grand government handouts in the form of 160-acre allotments throughout much of the western part of the United States under the terms of the Homestead Acts. That's the beginning of the racial wealth divide.
Centuries. You talk about solutions, William Darity, which include public banking programs, among other things, federally funded jobs programs right now. Talk about that one specifically. How would it work?
So let me distinguish between programs that are intended to address general inequality in the United States versus programs that are intended to address racial inequality in the United States. So the reparations program is specific to addressing racial inequality in the United States. The other types of policies that you've just mentioned are intended to address general inequality in the United States, although some of them may have a disproportionate benefit for black Americans. Specifically, the important one that I think we have to focus on in the context of the current unemployment crisis is the federal job guarantee. And the premise here is that the United States government would assure every adult American of an employment opportunity in the public sector at wages that surpass the poverty level, accompanied by a benefits package that would be similar to the benefits package that's available to all federal civil servants. The premise here is that everyone would have an assurance of work. We could move directly to full employment in the economy at any point in time, regardless of whether we were in prosperous times or we're in a depressed economy. And we would have the capacity to ensure that everyone would receive earnings at non-poverty levels. So we could simultaneously have full employment and we could eliminate poverty in the United States.
What's the mechanism for making that happen?
Political action. It's very interesting that you ask that question insofar as the federal job guarantee is an idea that has substantial public support, even though it has not translated into comparable support and action by our political figures. But I think the last poll that I saw said at the national level that 70% of Americans would be in favor of having the federal government ensure that everyone has access to a job.
William Darity, I know we need to let you go. You have another obligation. But before you leave us, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this moment in history and the protests that we've been seeing across this country, the horrific death of George Floyd at the hands of the police officers. What goes through your heart? What goes through your mind as you see all this?
My heart bleeds. My soul has some measure of optimism that the kind of response that the American people have given to visible evidence of these types of outrages holds the promise that we will pursue the types of social policies that will reverse and go far beyond the kinds of oppressive conditions that have existed in our country.
William Darity is professor of public policy, African American studies and economics at Duke University. William Darity, thank you very much for your time today. I've so appreciated listening to you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Derek Hamilton, Valerie Wilson, jump back in here. William Darity speaks about a federal jobs guarantee program. Derek Hamilton, you have talked about that sort of as a referred to it as a new deal. What do you make of it? Is that something you support?
I absolutely support a federal job guarantee. And with 20 million people unemployed right now, even as the economy opens up and we start to absorb people back into the labor force, we would be remiss to think that this will not have an impact in terms of duration and despair that's placed on American people if we don't have something on par and like a federal job guarantee, and frankly, a federal job guarantee, because it will implement structural improvements so that the next time we have a pandemic, the next time we have a climate catastrophe or any other economic downturn, we'll have a mechanism, an automatic feature of the U.S. Economy to absorb workers quickly and also to place resources in areas that need it the most. That's another feature of a federal job guarantee.
Well, Derek Hamilton, several White House hopefuls have turned to you for your research, for your policy ideas, from Elizabeth Warren to Cory Booker to Bernie Sanders. And now you're part of the Sanders to Biden task force. Let me play this clip from Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, laying out his general election economic argument.
Making sure everyone has paid sick leave and child care support. Remaking our system of unemployment insurance into employment insurance to help people keep their jobs and get them in the first place. Putting millions of people to work, building a new green economy that will position us to own the 21st century.
Derek Hamilton, does Joe Biden get it? Does he understand the issues facing African Americans today?
I hope so. I mean, that clip that you played expresses an empathy and an understanding that we need to shift our economy. I hope we even push even further and use this civil unrest, and as well as some of the features that William Darity laid out in terms of public opinion, to recognize that this system is at a brink and we can go one of two ways. And that's the scary part. The counter to Joe Biden's rhetoric is that of Donald Trump. And, you know, I'll just be frank and say that it is fascism calling for police states and in order to protect capital and use the U.S. military to impose virtually martial law on our people. That's a pathway, unfortunately, that is not rooted out and is a possibility. So I hope we go the other way towards justice.
Derek Hamilton, thank you. Let me get a caller in here, Sean in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Sean, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to say, in living in the South, I'm born and raised in New York City, and I moved to the South in the 1996. And so I get to see many situations where young people make bad decisions when they're young. And then when they're older, they reap the consequences of those bad decisions. And often it lasts generations. And I've seen that growing up in my adult life. And so the point I'm trying to make is when people make bad, young ones make bad decisions, they choose to drop out of school, they choose to get involved with people who are not concerned with their future, you reap what you sow. And oftentimes, the next generation has to deal with those consequences. So one of the things I tell young people is just break the cycle. Don't make the wrong decisions that the previous generation has made. If you make the right decisions through your life and recognize people who are trying to help you and accept that help, you have a good chance of making it.
Sean, thank you very much for the call. Valerie Wilson, would you respond?
Yeah, I want to be clear that I think it's important that we don't isolate young Black youth from other youth. All young people make choices that perhaps aren't the best decisions at the time. I don't think that's anything unique to Black youth. I think that the response to that often is different than when we see those same sorts of decisions being made by white youth. So again, I think this gets to addressing our broader structural issues beyond and aside of just talking about individual responsibility and accountability.
Beyond the New Deal that we referenced, I just want to, before we go here, talk about some innovative ideas on housing and higher education. Derek Hamilton, you talked about canceling all student debt. What's the one thing that you think is a bright light on the horizon as we talk about policy issues, as we talk about change here, Derek?
And this is another point. With the New Deal, it recognizes that there is no silver bullet, but a package of goods. And that package of goods has to be framed. And it's related to the caller's point on emphasizing choice. Choice really is an illusion if you don't have the resources by which you can make a sound choice. So what a new deal would be to offer all people the necessary ingredients so that they can have true agency, authentic agency. You know, we say the markets give you choice. Well, that's inauthentic if you lack any foundation by which to make a choice. If you're hungry, if you lack shelter, if you don't have access to education, if you don't have access to capital. So what a new deal would do in a nutshell would identify the necessary functional goods, the necessary capability goods, the necessary goods that everybody needs in order to make choices in their lives and make sure that there is adequate quality, quantity, and universal access to them across the board. Mm-hmm. And we can be specific and out of the weeds, a right to health care, a right to shelter, a right to a decent income, the right to a job, the right to having access to the scoring mechanisms that allow you to get access to credit, the access to a banking account. You know, in the 21st century, as Valerie Wilson pointed out earlier, or one of the callers pointed out earlier, if you can't get access to the $1,200 check that the government is sending out because you don't have an electronic account, that is a failing of government. We have Social Security accounts that are generated pretty much at birth. Mm-hmm. We can generate an account for everybody so that they can not be. Yep. And I'll stop there. Okay. But I guess that's what I'm saying. It's a new deal would be a package of goods and services so that everybody can have authentic choice in their life.
No, I love it. I appreciate it. And it's very articulately stated. Valerie Wilson, wrap us up here. Beyond policy, what's one thing that each listener who's tuning in today can do to start to make the changes necessary based on the problems that we've outlined in this hour?
I would say probably the easiest and first thing that people can do is vote. We are in an election year. We have an election coming up in November. It's very important that the protests, the outrage, the vocal objection to the status quo that we're seeing in the streets, that we translate that into political action by voting.
Well, I appreciate so much both of you for your perspectives on this very important issue. And I'm glad we devoted an hour to this because... boy, is it worth it. Valerie Wilson, Director of the Economic Policy Institute's Program on Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy. Thank you so much for being with us today and for your research, Valerie. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
Derek Hamilton, Executive Director of the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. Derek, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. And thank you, Valerie, too.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Have a good weekend, everyone. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.